This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Utterly Moderate is the official podcast of the Connors Institute for Nonpartisan Research and Civic Engagement at Shippensburg University. Please visit us at connorsinstitute.org to sign up for our free email newsletter. While you are there, also be sure to check out all of our great research and resources.
Please listen carefully. Carefully.
Hey, hey, everyone. Welcome back to the program. This is the Utterly Moderate podcast, and I'm your host, Lawrence Eppard. I am really under the weather today, so I apologize for my voice. Before we bring on today's guest, I've got some really cool news to share with you. The Connors Forum has a new name. We are now officially the Connors Institute for Nonpartisan Research and Civic Engagement at Shippensburg University. And you can find us at our new web address, connorsinstitute.org. We're going to continue this podcast the same way we've always done it. We're going to continue the Connors newsletter, and we'll continue to be aggressively nonpartisan. But in addition to all that, we're going to bring on some research fellows to increase the research output at Connors. We're going to hold community events, and I'm sure we're going to live stream those events. So for our listeners who don't live in Pennsylvania, which is most of you, you can be a part of those events. I'm really, really excited about this development. Our university president, Dr. Charles Patterson, he had this to say about the new institute, quote, "We are excited to welcome the Connors Institute to Shippensburg University. The work of the institute is of great value to our students, faculty, and staff, but more importantly, to our collective society. With unprecedented political discourse and a great need for unbiased and evidence-based knowledge, the Connors Institute can provide a path forward for those seeking to see the return of civility within our democracy," end quote. I'm really excited to both continue and to expand upon this relationship with Shippensburg University. It's a really wonderful place to live and to teach and to learn. I know a lot of my listeners probably have teenagers getting ready to think about where they want to go to college and if they want to attend college. If that's you, come pay us a visit. We've got these really cool open houses. I think you'll be really impressed by the really warm and intellectually vibrant community that we have here. All right, well, I'm excited about the Connors Institute, and I'm excited about today's guest. We've got Washington University in St. Louis poverty scholar Mark Rank. Mark is one of the leading poverty researchers in the entire country. He is here to talk to us about his work, about a new book that he has coming out, about the record low poverty rate that we had in 2021, and much more. So, Mark Rank, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Lawrence. Great to be with you.
All right, Mark. So before we talk about your life course risk of poverty work, before we talk about the poverty risk calculator, all this new book you got coming out in 2024, I do want to peel back the curtain a little bit and tell our listeners something about how I know you. So you and I have written two books together, Poorly Understood, Rugged Individualism. We've done some articles. You've had chapters included in books that I've written. And so we've done a lot of stuff together. But I want to peel back the curtain a bit and tell people how this relationship began. So I went to, I got my PhD at the University of Florida. And I graduated in 2013. So I got there around, I think, 2008. And I wasn't really quite sure, to be honest. Like, I knew I was studying sociology, but I really wasn't quite sure what I wanted to study. And I had an interest in inequality, interest in poverty, but it was by no means what I was going to focus my career on. But I can tell you the exact article that led me to decide that I was going to make my primary focus social stratification and inequality. It was an article called American Poverty as a Structural Failing, Evidence and Arguments by Mark Robert Rank. I believe there was a couple. Who were the other authors on that article?
It was Tom Herschel and a graduate student.
So I read this article and it just kind of, not kind of, I read this article and it completely changed my life. I thought it was excellent. The arguments I thought were brilliant, and it just made me think about inequality in a different way. And that set me on my path. And so I actually went to my PhD advisor and I said, this is what I want to do. This is exactly what I want to do. I want to do this kind of work. I think this is amazing. I think I wrote you an email. You probably don't remember it. I wrote you it many years ago and I said, I love your article, big fan of your work. And you wrote back something nice, and that was that. And so I decided I was going to study poverty, economic inequality, racial inequality. That was going to be my focus. That's what I got my PhD in. And of course, that means those were the jobs that I was going to apply for. And that was the work that I was going to do as a sociologist. And so I got to my first job at Radford University, and I was there in 2014, 2015. And I decided I wanted to bring some speakers to campus. And of course, I mean, who else to ask but my big hero, Mark Robert Rank, who's after I read that article, I read another book called One Nation Underprivileged by Mark, which I thought was, I mean, it's probably my one of my favorite books of all time. And so I reach out to Mark and I bring him to my university and he does a big talk. He actually, in a really cheesy, really, my kids would call it a cringe moment. I had you sign an article for me. I have it framed in my office. I'll show it to you. It's framed here somewhere. Hold on. Now, Mark, I took it out of the frame because the frame broke. But for the air, you have to pretend like it's framed. But here's the article.
Yeah.
And there's your signature.
Oh, yeah.
That's from Radford University. And so while you were there, I remember, so I picked you up from the airport. I took a wrong turn and you were like kind of looking at me with your side eye like, really, this is where you live? You don't know where to go? And anyway, so it made the drive long. And I remember telling you about a variety of projects I was working on because you asked, because you're a nice guy. And you said, so what are you working on? And I told you. And one of them in particular, you became really interested in. You said, yeah, if you want some help with that, then let me know. Of course, I assumed you were lying. I assumed, right, like this big poverty scholar doesn't give a crap about my work. But I kept that in my mind. And later on, when I was working on that project, I contacted you and I said, I'd be really interested in having you help. And you did. And so we wrote Rugged Individualism together. We then wrote another book, Poorly Understood Together. You've actually come to Shippensburg and talked here. I've had you do some Zoom presentations. And so all that stems from you completely, talk about random luck. I discovered one of your articles. It set me on my path for my PhD for what I wanted to study. And then you personally have profoundly shaped my career.
Oh, you know, that's just, I can't tell you how much that means to me, Lawrence. You know, you, our relationship and collaboration has really meant a lot to me over the last, I guess, over the last 10 years or so. So just thanks so much. And, you know, it's sort of in this this book that I have coming out in April, I have acknowledgments and I say, you know, it's very appropriate in a book on luck and chance to thank your lucky stars. And one of the things I say is that, you know, I want to thank the teachers and scholars that came before me because they've had a profound influence on me. And it's sort of, you know, it's Newton's sort of thing. If I've seen farther, it's only standing on the shoulders of giants and seeing further. And I say, you know, as a teacher, it's so heartwarming when, you know, out of the blue years later, you might hear from a student that says, you know, you really had an effect on the way that I went. You taught that course or you wrote that article or something like that. So I just, it's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, and I've told you this before, I kind of considered you my PhD advisor. I was like, you had such a huge impact on my direction and how I thought about poverty and, you know, just how I frame my research questions. And
And you've gone on to do, you know, such great stuff. And, you know, the Connor Forum and all of this kind of thing is just, you know, absolutely terrific. So kudos to you.
Well, we'll stop making the listeners sick and we'll move on and we'll talk about your work. Now, you did something really, really interesting. And I gotta admit to you on the air here, Mark, I'm insanely jealous of you. I've always been insanely jealous of you. I mean, you know, being this big pioneer and the life course risk of poverty, all that kind of stuff. But like, that would have been enough. I would have always held this grudge of like, ah, he's so good. And then you took it one step further and you created something called the Poverty Risk Calculator. So this is just one of the coolest things I have ever seen a scholar do. So if you go to confrontingpoverty.org, you can find something called the Poverty Risk Calculator. And this comes directly from Mark Rank. So Mark, tell us, what is the risk calculator?
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Lawrence. You know, so after doing all this research and, you know, writing about it and doing analysis and stuff like that, I was thinking, I kind of come out of this tradition from Wisconsin, which is sort of the idea that extension of research is important. It's important to not only do this stuff for our own benefit, but also societal benefit and for other people. And so I thought, how can I take this research and make it accessible to people so that they can use it? And, you know, I was thinking about that and I thought, you know, a really good analogy to what I'd like to do are the heart disease risk calculators that you find on the internet. So as you know, you can go to many different sites. You put in your numbers, your cholesterol, your blood pressure, your age, all that kind of stuff, and it will give you a 10-year risk of experiencing a heart attack. And that's based on a long-term longitudinal study called the Framingham Heart Study. And I thought, could I do the same thing with the poverty numbers? Instead of a heart attack risk, what's the risk of experiencing poverty? So, you know, it took a lot to kind of get this thing calculated and analyzed and all that stuff. But yeah, so I've created this along with Tom at Cornell. We created this this website called Confronting Poverty, and sort of the centerpiece of it is a poverty risk calculator. So what it does is it says you what you can look at is your 5, 10, or 15-year risk of experiencing poverty based on 5 characteristics: your age, your gender, race, education, and your marital status. And based upon all this longitudinal research, this will give you an actual probability or estimate. And you can see how that estimate might change depending on, you know, if you change your education level and these other things. So it's really pretty interesting, because what it's doing is it's taking research and it's putting it in the hands of the general public and allowing them to use this to look at their own personalized risk. So I think it's a really, I'm proud of putting that together. And, you know, it's to date, you know, I was looking at this the other day, we've had over 2 million visitors to the site from literally every country in the world. Has at least a few people have come to this site, which is really pretty amazing. So, and it's being used in various contexts in high schools and colleges and different organizations and things like that. So, I just think it's a very cool example of what you and I, you know, refer to as public sociology or public research, of taking research and putting it in the public domain.
Now, I got to ask you this question. This is, you know, this podcast is educational. It's mostly academic. But I got to ask you this question. So if I were you, if I'm Mark Rank and I'm in the shower and I'm thinking, poverty risk calculator. If I were you, like, knowing that it's going to take a lot of computer coding and, you know, crunching data, all that kind of stuff, like, I would be really protective of the idea. I wouldn't want to tell anybody about it because I'd be thinking like, I want to get this out there as quickly as possible before somebody else does it. Did you have that urge?
That thought had crossed my mind. I did think that. But then I quickly thought, you know, I don't think anybody's going to do this anyway. So, yeah, but that thought did cross my mind. And it probably was in the shower.
We're going to talk about a lot of your work and the different cool things that you're doing. But let's start with, I think, the thing that you're probably most well known for, which is your work in the life course risk of poverty. So most of our listeners are not academics. And so could you tell us, what does it mean to study the life course risk of poverty? And how is that different from how people normally look at poverty in the U.S.?
Yeah. So kind of the typical way that we often think about poverty is basically at a point in time, how many folks are poor, you know, in a given year. And those are the kind of numbers that are reported. And generally, it's around 11, 12, 13% of the population fall into poverty in any given year. And that's certainly a valid way of thinking about it. But another way of thinking about it is, you know, what's my long-term risk? Not just this year or the coming year, but maybe over the next 15, 20, 25 years, what's the likelihood that I might fall into poverty? And that's a really interesting and unique way of thinking about this. It's kind of related to thinking about, you know, other kinds of risks, like what's my risk of having a heart attack or what's my risk of something else happening to me? So my colleague at Cornell, Tom Hirsch, and I have been, you know, working on this particular question for a long period of time. And basically, the bottom line is that when you look over a 25, 30, or 35-year time span, the risk of poverty for Americans is actually really, really high. So depending on how you define poverty, between the ages of 20 and 75, three-quarters or 75% of Americans will experience either a year below the official poverty line or will experience a year very close to being below the official poverty line, so poverty or near poverty. And that's, you know, when you think about it, three-quarters of Americans will experience a year in poverty or near poverty. That's really, really significant. And you know, the question that I get a lot of times from people is, well, how can those numbers be so high? How can that percentage be so high? And the reason is, when you look over a long window of time, there are things that can happen to people that they didn't anticipate. So things like, you know, losing a job or getting sick. So when those things occur, people are at a very great risk of falling into poverty. And so that's kind of the bottom line here. And kind of the one of the ideas behind this is to say, you know, we often think about poverty as an issue of them rather than an issue of us. But what this life course work implies is that actually poverty is an issue for the majority of folks in terms of experiencing it firsthand.
Before we move on, I just want to underscore the point you made. So if you use the official poverty line, now I think the numbers you use are important as well, like near poverty is still really economically insecure. But even if you just use the official poverty line, like you say, between 11, 12, 13%, depending upon the given year of the populations in poverty. But I believe what you found was by old age, it was like 59% of Americans would be under the official poverty line. So again, much higher numbers under other thresholds, which are clearly struggling. But even just using that most conservative number, that it's still a majority of Americans. That's a lot of people. And your point of this issue of, I think many people think of it as something that happens to other people, but I think your work shows that no, it's going to happen to most of us, right?
Yeah. And actually, if you use a wider measure of thinking about economic insecurity, so in a book a few years ago on the American Dream, we kind of took a broader approach and said, okay, what's the likelihood of Americans between 25 and 60 experiencing a year of significant economic insecurity? And that involved either experiencing a year of poverty or near poverty, using a social safety net program, or having a spell of unemployment during the year. And if you use that measure, then again, between 25 and 60, 79% of the American population will experience at least 1 year of economic insecurity, and 50% will experience 3 or more years of economic insecurity. So if you take a bit of a broader perspective, again, the bottom line is that, you know, 4/5 of Americans at some point are really going to experience some very serious economic troubles.
And my understanding is that you're kind of known as being one of the first people to really explore this life course risk, right? I mean, you're kind of known as one of the first, right?
I believe I am. Yeah, no. And that was the kind of, that was the question when we started this, you know, 20 some odd years ago, was I was thinking, you know, we know a lot about, again, the risk of poverty in any given year. We know something about the longitudinal dynamics of how long our people are poor and how often they experience poverty. But there really wasn't anything looking at this life course sort of risk of poverty. And I thought, you know, well, this is something that definitely should be looked at, because again, what it does is it shifts the conversation. It shifts the conversation, I think, from saying, you know, poverty is not just something that's going to affect some other group. I actually have a pretty strong risk of experiencing poverty at some point. But people don't see that because it's not in the immediate future. It's a long-term risk. And we don't often perceive that. And that's why I think that, you know, again, this work is so important, is because it shows that that's a very, very significant, it's a very significant issue for actually most Americans.
So many people who are listening to our conversation are probably wondering what's the cause. And I think you alluded to it in your previous response, which is, if you look at poverty spells, you know, people who fall into poverty in the U.S. in any given year, as you said, the two biggest reasons that people tend to fall into poverty are either a loss of earnings or a marriage breakup or you know, a breakup of a relationship, right?
That's right. Those two are major reasons for people falling into poverty. The other one are health-related reasons. That's the whole idea behind insurance, behind like having car insurance or home insurance. You don't expect your home to burn down tomorrow, but you do realize that over the long term, something may happen and that you should have some protection in place. That's the concept behind a social safety net. And I think a lot of Americans think, oh, this won't happen to me. I'm not going to experience poverty. But the research shows that actually, you know, again, most people will at some point experience poverty. Now, the plus side, the sort of positive spin on this whole story is that most people who do experience poverty do so for a fairly short period of time. They're generally, you know, maybe a year or two in poverty, and then they're able to get back on their feet and do probably okay. And then something down the road may happen. So as you know, and you know, we've done research on this, the typical pattern of poverty is a much more fluid pattern than the idea of people in poverty for 10, 15, 20 years in a row. There certainly is a small segment of the poverty population that is long-term, you know, folks long-term in poverty, but that's only a small piece of everybody who experiences poverty.
Yeah, now don't quote me on this. If you're listening to this, go look for yourself at Ann Huff Stevens' research. But she wasn't the first one to do poverty spells research, but she's done some updated research on it and some really good research on it. And as Mark said, I think if I remember correctly, and you and I included this in a book we recently did, but
yeah,
I think it was something like within 2 years, mm-hmm. I think about 70% mm-hmm. of people who had fallen mm-hmm. into poverty mm-hmm. will exit poverty. Now, as you said, I think within something like 5 years, about half of those people will mm-hmm. fall back into poverty. But again,
that's right.
They tend to be short stints, not, you know, not 5, 10, you know, 15 years, whatever.
Right. And I think that raises another interesting question, which is that there are different different experiences in terms of poverty. So a lot of poverty is short term, and we might think of certain strategies for addressing that. And then again, there is a small group of folks that are in poverty for much longer periods of time, and their problems and their issues are quite different. So these are folks that are at a significant disadvantage in terms of competing in the labor market. They may have physical disabilities, single parents. They may be living in economically really depressed areas that don't have a lot of opportunities, you know, inner city areas or remote rural areas. And so, you know, when we think about poverty, it is important to keep in mind that there are different dimensions to poverty and different ways that people experience poverty.
So, Mark, so we had a big development in the world of poverty scholars recently. In 2021, we had something historic happen, which is we had the lowest poverty rate on record, 7.8% overall. If you look at the supplemental measure, 5.2% for children. So when I was in the midst of the pandemic, as somebody who studies economic inequality, I thought for sure the numbers were going to skyrocket, but the opposite happened. So tell us, what happened in 2021?
Well, it was historic. And what happened was that the government decided to do something in terms of social policy. And that was the sort of using a refundable child tax credit and giving that to folks on a monthly basis. And the estimate is that that cut, as you pointed out, it cut childhood poverty in the United States by something like 35 or 40%, which is really, really dramatic. And, you know, and that's when we compare the United States to other countries. Many other countries have what's known as child allowances. And so families with kids are given a monthly kind of stipend that helps them to raise those kids. And that has a dramatic effect on reducing poverty.
You know, it's interesting. For years, and I'm sure you did the same thing, for years in my classes, I would talk about the U.S. poverty rate relative to other countries in the world. And obviously, we do better than many countries in the world, but there are many wealthy countries that do better than us. And so you'd point to, you know, the Denmarks and the Finlands and a variety of other countries. And you talk about the different policies that existed. And as you said, one of the policies is a child allowance. And what was really interesting is it was kind of an abstract conversation. It wasn't a policy that we had, and you didn't really know how it would work here. But what happened with 2021, inadvertently, by the way, the government was just trying to backstop all American families, right? But inadvertently, we kind of taught the lesson of, hey, these policies really work, right? So we implemented something very similar to those countries for different reasons, but very similar to those countries. And what did we get? We got a historic reduction. And we actually got a poverty rate, a child poverty rate, which looked like a Scandinavian country.
That's right. And sort of that policy is kind of a variation on the idea of a universal basic income or a sort of a minimal guaranteed income in which, you know, what you're saying is that, you know, nobody should fall below a certain income floor. And if you do that, we're going to make up the difference and get you up to a certain point. And it's interesting that, you know, that is now has become part of the conversation, part of the social policy conversation. It was actually President Nixon in the early 1970s that proposed a variation of this idea, the negative income tax, and that got very close to passing Congress, and was, you know, a topic of conversation in the 1970s, and then kind of fell out of favor, and has now kind of come back as a way of thinking about dealing with poverty. You know, if you want to address poverty, the most straightforward way is to transfer cash. Now, there's a problem with that in the United States because people are going to say, hey, you're giving people something for nothing. And that goes against this idea because, you know, what we want to do is basically in our social policy, we want to say, you know, if we're going to give you something, we're going to demand something in return. And so we have the kind of structure that we have today in the United States, but the kind of the idea of a universal basic income goes against that. And from a pragmatic point of view, I think it's a much more straightforward way of really addressing poverty than the kind of policies that we have now.
Now, we should be clear that there were not, this was not without drawbacks. So I've talked to a few economists about this, and they argue that now this isn't the only reason why we have inflation, but because those tax credits and those checks went to all income groups, not just they weren't means tested. I think many scholars agree that it probably contributed to inflation. Now, the question is how much it contributed, of course, and I can't settle that for you. But so it's not without drawbacks. You need to be clear about how you're doing it, you know, who gets it, what the amount should be. But and those are things we should all hash out politically, right? But just in terms of the effectiveness, I think the lesson we learned in 2021 was it works.
Yeah. And the other side of that is when you do transfer money to lower income folks, they spend that money. And that actually results in a more robust economy. Now, it could also, as you point out, it could also lead to inflation as a side issue. But it does generate economic, you know, economic activity. So, and I would, you know, I've been thinking about this issue a little bit. And sort of my tendency in terms of thinking of like a universal or a guaranteed minimum income would be to go more the guaranteed minimum income approach, because I think it's more cost effective. And the idea there is to say, we're not going to just transfer money to everybody in society. What we're going to say is that if you fall below a certain, we're going to make sure that you're not going to fall below a certain income level. And if you do, we're going to make up the difference. And I think that's it's a more targeted approach. I think that's an easier sell than to just say, okay, we're going to just transfer, you know, a certain amount of income to everybody in the United States. I think that's harder to do. It's certainly much more expensive to do that.
So we have this huge lesson that we learn in 2021, and poverty geeks like you and I find it very interesting, and obviously poor people find it very interesting. But then those relief measures expire, and something else happens in 2022. And as Mark knows, we don't see the poverty numbers till about September of every year. The Census Bureau aggregates all those and analyzes them and then puts them out. And so in 2022, those numbers, so it was 7.8% for the overall population, and it was 5.2% for the child population. And then both of those numbers jumped back up to over 12% in 2022.
Yeah. And I mean, and you raised at the very beginning, sort of there's a difference between the what's known as the official poverty measure and the supplemental poverty measure. And these kind of transfers are picked up in the supplemental poverty measure, which is including, you know, tax credits that people are getting. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, this is like, you know, there you go. I mean, the policy cut poverty, and then when we got rid of it, poverty shot back up.
All right, Mark. So before we wrap up, you know, you've done a lot of great work. You know, One Nation Underprivileged was an excellent book. Chasing the American Dream, Poorly Understood, which we wrote together. We wrote Rugged Individualism together. You've got a ton of stuff out there. You've got your website, you've got articles. And yet you have even more coming down the pike. So I think you have several projects coming to the market here soon. But I believe that the one that's coming soonest is in April. You've got a new book coming out about luck. So tell us about this new book.
Yeah. I'm very excited about it. So the title of the book is The Random Factor. And the subtitle, you know, academics always have a subtitle. The subtitle is How Chance and Luck Profoundly Shape Our Lives and the World Around Us. And kind of, you know, we've talked about this over the years. The beginning of this book really took place with the Chasing the American Dream book. In that book, it was about the American Dream. And one of the ways that I wanted to get at that was interviewing about 75 people in the St. Louis area from all walks of life and listening to their stories and sort of, you know, what their sense of the American Dream was and all that kind of thing. But as they talked about their lives, what people sort of repeatedly brought up without any prodding from me was this idea of chance and luck in their lives. And they would say things like, you know, if this hadn't happened, if I hadn't met that person, if I didn't get that telephone call, I'd be in a different place than I am right now. And I thought, that's really interesting because, you know, in social science, there's not a lot of discussion about the role of chance and luck in affecting our lives. And so I kind of put that away, stored that away, and the result is this book that's coming out in April. And I just think it's fascinating. It's looking at various ways in which chance and luck and randomness have really shaped, again, our lives and the world around us. So the book is divided kind of into three sections. The first section looks at kind of the wider world, the wider context, and looks at how history has been shaped often by chance events, looks at the natural world, you know, the idea of, for example, evolution is basically one of the key components is chance, random mutations and things like that. And then looking at our everyday lives and how in various aspects chance and luck play out. The middle section deals with the dynamics of our lives and how it's shaped by these chance and luck events. And then the last third is what can we learn from this, both in terms of social policy and in terms of personal lessons. So I think, you know, everybody can relate to this topic of, you know, when you ask people, like if I were to say, you know, how'd you meet your significant other? I'm sure there was some chance and luck elements to it. You know, you happen to meet at a party or you happen to this or that or that. So, you know, everybody can relate to this. And I just think it's just a fascinating subject. So I'm very excited about this book. And I think it's going to be, to tell you the truth, I believe this is the best thing I've written because I think it's a fantastic read.
Well, I do have to say, and of course I'm biased as well, but I do have to say, and this is the honest to God truth, among social scientists, I think you're known as one of the better writers. Your books are engaging. You always incorporate a lot of, you know, there's biblical lessons that you incorporate in, you know, there's, you know, stories from the civil rights movement. I mean, you always weave in all these interesting little tidbits.
Yeah. And, you know, a little while ago, I remember you saying, you know, does this book kind of go counter to all of your research on? So here's a way to think about this. You know, you and I are sociologists, and sociologists often look at how certain structures affect behavior. So we look at race, class, gender, the effects that has. What this book does is a couple things with that. It says, yes, there are strong currents in our lives that push us forward, like class. But within those currents, there are many ripples of randomness. And also randomness plays out differently depending on where you lie in the social structure. And it can have the effect of exacerbating inequalities. So I talk about how inequality is affected by the issue of luck and chance, which to me is a really new kind of, there's not a lot of people talking about that. And that's kind of a unique take on you know, kind of bringing some of my other work to bear on thinking about chance and luck. So, but I remember you were saying this about, you know, is this sort of negate all the stuff that you've done? And I would say, no, it isn't at all. It's sort of added another dimension.
Now, I read a very early copy, really early draft of one of your chapters. Mm-hmm. So this may not be in the book anymore, but from what I remember early on, at least, you had some examples of some famous people in their lives and how chance led their lives to take different turns. Did you leave those in the book? Are there any interesting stories in there? Can you give us a little tease of one of them?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's that, you know, the book is full of just different examples of people whose lives have been, you know, interviews that I did or found in other places. You know, one person that was just very profound that's in the book that was also in my American Dream book was a woman by the name of Hedy Epstein. And she was a little girl that grew up in Nazi Germany. And the only reason she got out of there to save her life was simply chance and luck. And she got put on the Kinder transport, the children's train out in 1939, got out of Germany right before the war started. And, you know, all of her family were killed. But it was pure chance that she got out. And then the other interesting thing about this idea of chance and luck is, what do you do with those opportunities when they come your way? Are you aware of certain things that may become that you may become aware of as a result of chance and luck? So she was an example, somebody who thanked her lucky stars and said, "You know what? I'm going to do for others what this opportunity gave for me, and I'm going to help others along the way." And she became this really strong social justice activist. That's a very, very, it's a very profound story, but there's many, many stories that I have about, you know, people in entertainment, scientists, just a whole range of people that show how their lives have been bent and shaped by a really chance event.
All right, Mark, before I let you go, when is this new book coming out?
So the publication date is, I believe, April 23rd, and it is with University of California Press. It will be one of their main books for the year, and you know should be available everywhere.
All right, so April 2024, brand new book from Mark Rank. Give us the title again.
The title is The Random Factor: How Chance and Luck Profoundly Shape Our Lives and the World Around Us.
I'm really looking forward to reading it. Mark, great friend, great colleague. I think you're a wonderful scholar, and I really thank you for coming back on the program and talking with us today.
Thanks so much, Lawrence. It's always fantastic to talk with you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you. Again.
Goodbye, good luck, and may the good Lord take a liking to you.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.